Hello, this is Meredith Irvine, editor of CompensationStandards.com. Welcome to another episode of the Pay and Proxy podcast. Today, my guest is Ryan Posey, counsel at Skadden in the Labor and Employment Group. He's one of the authors of a recent Skadden article addressing 9 mistakes companies make when transitioning CEOs and how to avoid them. And we'll be discussing some of those mistakes and Skadden's tips on today's podcast. Welcome, Ryan.
Thanks, Meredith.
Before we discuss your memo, can you tell us a little bit about you and your practice?
Yes. So, Meredith, my practice is a unique hybrid practice in that I litigate and do transactional work. And pertinent to this podcast and this audience, I participate in negotiating new CEO arrangements, but also assisting our clients with transitioning out CEOs and negotiating the arrangements that are related to that transition out.
Perfect. And jumping right into your memo, for purposes of this discussion, I kind of thought of the 9 mistakes that you identified in a few different categories. 2 of those mistakes relate to compensation that may be due to the current CEO, and then also the comp package being offered to the new CEO. Can you discuss those mistakes and also your suggestions for avoiding them?
Absolutely. So I think it's pretty clear that severance and compensation packages are arguably the most important consideration in connection with the termination and the hiring of a CEO for a variety of reasons, one of which is just behavioral incentives. Another key reason is how the compensation or severance packages are perceived by shareholders. And of course, there is personal importance to the executive. So I'll talk with the current CEO who's transitioning out about some of the mistakes that are made and some ways to avoid them. So severance entitlements of a departing CEO are often established by individual agreements or broad-based plans, change in control plans, severance plans, equity compensation awards, supplemental pension arrangements, and whatnot. The first mistake that we often see is not quantifying the current CEO's compensation and benefits entitlements and the impact that those entitlements might have on the company's financials when that CEO is transitioning out. One suggestion that we have to avoid that issue is first looking at a proxy statement as an initial matter, and secondly, having the right expertise under the tent to confirm that the quantification of the severance entitlements is correct. I think the last thing any company wants to do when they're transitioning a CEO out is to run into a situation where they run out of cash or run their cash too low and get into an issue with having to fulfill orders or bring in a new CEO or change the current CEO's entitlement when they're departing the company. Second mistake we often see for the departing CEO is just not gathering and reviewing the actual agreements. The board has to be prepared for the possibility that some of these agreements are not going to be readily accessible. For example, equity awards are often kept by the human resources department, where accessing them could compromise the confidentiality of the CEO termination process that the board is seeking to keep. So one issue or one thought to mitigate the issue would be advanced planning to ensure that the actual agreements are in the hands of the board or a committee like the compensation committee, or bringing somebody under the tent in the HR group or legal group who has access to these documents and can be discreet and trustworthy. Some of the terms that you see in the actual employment, severance, or equity award agreements and whatnot may come as a surprise to the board, and that's why it's important to actually review these agreements. One common surprise that comes to the attention of the board when they're thinking of transitioning out a CEO is that there might be advance notice of a termination that's required, sometimes as high as 6 months before a termination can become effective, or a requirement to pay the CEO for that 6 months in lieu of the notice. This can affect the company's perception of what the severance costs are. So the notice cost would be on top of whatever severance entitlements arise under the employment agreement or other agreements that are at play here. That's why it's important to have a detailed analysis of the terms of all the relevant agreements prepared in advance and to provide enough time for inside and outside consultants to actually review the agreements and prepare that analysis. The absolute worst case scenario when companies do not gather and review the agreements is that the executive now has a material breach argument, and they can claim that they don't have to perform their obligations that would arise post-termination, such as their obligations to not compete or to not solicit employees or customers of their former employer. And so that's why it's important for companies to actually get their hands on the actual agreements and review them in detail. In some cases, CEOs might not have severance entitlements, or the board may determine that modifications are necessary. I touched upon earlier some economic considerations that boards need to consider when they're thinking of transitioning out a CEO. Some of the mistakes when you're modifying the severance entitlements or creating new severance entitlements is not considering how to frame or justify the new or modified entitlements to the departing CEO, or how it will be perceived by the public, such as shareholders or proxy advisory firms. The suggestion to avoid that mistake is just be principled. Come up with a legitimate justification for the offer, set expectations with the CEO, and honestly, be prepared to negotiate. CEOs are very sophisticated. They most often, if not always, will engage their own outside legal counsel who will be sophisticated themselves, and there will be some type of a negotiation process. And so boards and companies need to be prepared for that, especially when they're offering new severance or modifying current severance entitlements. Second mistake we see when the severance entitlements are changed or might be new is not considering how to justify those severance entitlements externally or how well they will be received. Will the company be at risk for adverse vote recommendations on say on pay or director reelections due to these types of compensation considerations? And relatedly, should those considerations affect the compensation and benefits that might be provided to the departing CEO? So companies just have to make sure that the entitlements that they're offering are reasonable, that the circumstances were such that the departing CEO would typically receive severance. If you're terminating a CEO with cause, it doesn't make sense, and it will not be well received that you're now offering severance entitlements to the CEO that they were not otherwise entitled to. Those are all considerations for departing CEOs. For new CEOs, I think the biggest mistake is not having the right internal and external teams in place to assist with formulating a well-reasoned offer of employment to this new CEO. There's a lot of questions that need to be considered when you are formulating this offer to the new CEO, including generally what compensation and benefits are going to be provided. And outside consultants are very helpful with a benchmarking exercise to make sure that the offer you give out is not offensive to the new CEO that you're trying to bring in. Will there be make-whole grants for compensation that the executive is leaving behind at his or her current employer? That's something that will always come into play in the negotiation process, and something that companies and boards need to be considering. What vesting conditions would be imposed on these make-whole grants? Will there be a formal fixed-term employment agreement or a severance agreement? Is there a company form agreement that is used and that might need to be revised or updated when it's provided to the new CEO? And as with the termination process, companies certainly need to consider whether the company's at risk for adverse vote recommendations on say on pay or director reelections due to comp considerations for the new CEO. Will there be new significant equity grants? Are there enough shares available under the current equity compensation plan to permit these new grants? And you also need to take into consideration any shares that might be forfeited by the departing CEO in this formula. And lastly, but certainly not least, are there any changes to existing forms of award agreements that need to be made in view of the new CEO's particular circumstances? So do vesting conditions or acceleration conditions need to change in light of the offer that's being made to this new CEO? So there's a lot of considerations, a lot of pitfalls there, but certainly I think prior preparation prevents poor performance. And so critically, it's very important for companies to get the right folks involved and to allow the process to play out.
Absolutely. That was chock full of important considerations that need to be thought through during this challenging process. The next topic you previewed in that answer, which is two mistakes in the memo relate to covenants in the CEO's employment agreement, and then also maybe more often overlooked contractual rights of other executives that might be implicated if the CEO is terminated. Can you talk about those provisions and how to avoid unforeseen impacts there?
Starting with covenants in the CEO's employment agreement, there could be enforceability risk with respect to the restricted covenants that are in the CEO's employment agreement, depending on the termination type. I think we're seeing a trend of general hostility towards non-competes. And so when I say restricted covenants, I mean non-competition covenants, non-solicitation covenants, and sometimes confidentiality covenants as well. Just yesterday, the New York State legislature passed a bill essentially that appears to be banning non-competes outright. And that follows a trend across many state legislatures and state courts also of increased hostility towards non-competes. And so courts in many states are going to weigh the termination type as a factor in determining whether to enforce a post-employment non-compete that might be in a CEO's separation agreement. Now, I would think that severance entitlements are beneficial to the employer's position that the non-compete should remain in effect. And I'm not aware of any court or state that has taken a position that a termination without cause or a resignation with good reason automatically per se means that the non-compete or non-solicit is not enforceable post-employment. But many courts will take the termination type. And if it is a discharge by the company, they'll take that into consideration when they're evaluating the totality of the circumstances as to whether a post-employment non-compete or non-solicit is or is not enforceable. In terms of the contractual rights of others, this is actually quite interesting. There oftentimes are good reason prongs in the employment agreements of other senior executives like the CFO or the COO or even the chief legal officer and other executives where the termination for any reason of a CEO would give that other executive the right to terminate their employment with good reason and by extension receive severance from the company because the CEO was terminated. Sometimes those executive employment agreements will specifically list the CEO's name and say, if this person is terminated, then you have the right to terminate your employment with good reason. Other times, and what's honestly more frequent, is the other executive employment agreements will say, if you no longer report to the CEO, then you will have good reason to terminate your employment. However, I have seen in my litigation experience, many senior executives claim that the termination of a particular CEO triggers their good reason, even when their good reason definition is more narrow and says, if you no longer report to the CEO, but does not list that CEO by name, executives still claim that they have good reason to terminate. And so it's important for companies to consider the agreements of other executives and whether their good reason prongs might be triggered with the termination of a particular CEO or a sort of reorganization of reporting lines. And it often comes as an unwelcome surprise. You most often have tunnel vision and think you're dealing with the CEO, but lo and behold, you have other issues that might be percolating in the background that you have to consider as well.
And you also address the human element here, right? In addition to the legal rights, a CEO transition can also impact retention. There's just relationship changes. And that's another thing that needs to be taken into account, which maybe there isn't much advice you can give at this point because that's very specific to the situation. But that was another important thing that the memo highlighted.
Absolutely. And I, you know, it is a always a tall task in replacing a CEO, particularly one who is well-liked. And there is a lot of consideration that needs to be given to how that will be received by other executives, or even, you know, from your rank and file employees all the way up to the top, and whether that might lead to certain turnover or retention issues, and how companies, you know, should be thinking about that is being sort of more proactive and coming up with a robust communications plan and making sure that the company and that its employees are bought into the vision that has been created by the board and the CEO, and that the board feels will be, you know, taken on and sort of enhanced or continued on the same path by the new CEO.
Absolutely. And that leads us well into our final question on the communications plan. Some of the mistakes you described in the memo relates to that. Can you discuss some of the complicating factors that need to be considered when you're publicly disclosing a CEO transition?
Yeah, for public companies, it's difficult. And I do want to touch upon sort of the internal messaging, because that's where we just left off. But I want to start with the disclosure requirements that the SEC has. And oftentimes, you've got your SEC disclosure requirements, you have a press release that's issued along with the filing of the 8K. And then you have internal messaging, and then you have follow-up with employees who might be concerned with the departure of the CEO, the direction of the company, and other related concerns. So timing is one important issue that needs to be considered. Starting with just the public disclosure requirements, companies generally have to file an 8K within 4 business days following the determination that the CEO will be terminated. So this obligation is triggered by the determination or agreement that the CEO will be terminated, but not the actual termination itself. So, for example, if the CEO's last day is July 1st, but you know, the company agreed with the CEO today, June 21st, that the CEO's employment would be ending, then that 4 business day time period starts today on June 21st. It does not start on July 1st. And so, you know, no disclosure is triggered by mere discussions or negotiations about whether to effect a termination. But when their matters have advanced beyond the stage, that is, you know, it might become more of a facts and circumstances determination. And so there's got to be care taken to manage the termination process in a way that does not result in a sort of premature requirement for disclosure that the company might view as potentially disruptive. So if the company was intending to, you know, disclose June 28th, as an example, they have to be very careful in how they are negotiating with the CEO and the CEO's counsel. And similarly, the CEO has to be careful in not tendering his or her resignation early, because that also triggers the disclosure requirement. So timing is important, because once that public disclosure requirement is triggered, you know, then you've got to start working on your 8K, you've got to start working on your press release. And concurrently with those filings, or shortly thereafter, you're going to want to have your internal sort of FAQ sent out to employees, and so that messaging is all received in a timely manner, and employees aren't learning about the termination on Twitter or on Facebook, or, you know, whatever news source is out there. Content is also important. The general rule on content for public disclosures is it's got to track the decision. So if it's an involuntary termination, you know, with or without cause, that is what the public disclosure needs to say. Similarly, if it's a, you know, resignation, you know, with good reason, that is what the public disclosure needs to say. So the disclosure has to track the actual decision. And oftentimes, the boards will bring in the CEO, and there will be a discussion about the termination type. And, you know, oftentimes CEOs want to characterize their termination as a resignation. And that is how, if it is characterized that way, if there is an agreement with the CEO and the board that it will be a resignation, that is what needs to be disclosed publicly. Interestingly, though, there are some considerations contractually as well. If it is a voluntary resignation, the board needs to also be thinking about whether that triggers the severance entitlement, and whether they had envisioned the termination triggering the severance entitlement as well. So, You've got the public disclosure considerations, you got the contractual considerations, you've got the press release considerations, which typically includes a little bit more information than what's in the 8K, and then you have internal messaging as well. And for internal messaging, it's very important to articulate the rationale for the actions. Companies need to anticipate the questions that employees may have. And then they need to respond to those questions proactively before they even arise. And so oftentimes companies will put together an FAQ that they will, you know, send internally to all of the employees so that they are anticipating the questions that may arise and they're getting ahead of them before gossip becomes what folks view as reality. You want to take control of the narrative early on. Companies need to consider whether to hire a consultant, a PR firm to participate and to help provide support for the rationale and related compensation decisions that come about. I mean, the PR firm obviously won't help with the compensation decisions. There'll be other consultants helping in that regard, but a PR firm might be helpful in sort of managing the internal and external messaging as well. And lawyers can be helpful in that regard too. Finally, in terms of communications, responsibility is important. Who's going to take part in drafting the press release? I mentioned earlier, the CEO often likes to involve himself or herself in the drafting of the press release. And so the board needs to consider whether that is something that they want to entertain. Who's going to communicate the decision to other executives and employees and other stakeholders like key customers, suppliers, regulators, or other constituencies? Is it going to be the chairman of the board? Is it going to be, the head of the compensation committee? Is it going to be another executive? Oftentimes it is, sort of the chairman of the board or the head of the compensation committee that will communicate these decisions, at least externally. And then internally, it's sometimes left to the next most senior person, whether that's the president or COO or CFO. Other times it's the head of human resources that will lead communications and filter all questions to that particular person as well. And then the companies need to consider that they've got the right individuals tasked with speaking on behalf of the company with questions that might come up from the press or that might come up from shareholders or employees as well. And oftentimes it's one person, sometimes it's a small team, but those individuals need to be prepared to respond to questions as they arise and have their own FAQs prepared and responses to those FAQs. And the companies finally need to be prepared to respond appropriately if any unauthorized communications are made. I mentioned controlling the narrative. That is always important in connection with a CEO transitioning out and also a new CEO coming in.
Brian, thank you so much. This was chock full of important information. CEO transitions, no matter how well planned they are so complex and so challenging. I think this was a great podcast topic. It was a great format for the memo in terms of taking mistakes and ways to avoid them. So I think this was an excellent resource for our listeners. For our listeners who are looking for more information on this, there are a few other topics and pointers covered in the Skadden memo, and that's posted on compensationstandards.com in our severance practice area. Thank you all for listening. And thanks again, Ryan, for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Meredith.